I mean, they're deep inside of the building, and somebody's worrying about grounding. And so finally what the guys did in desperation is they got a great big flower pot, and they put it on the table with dirt inside of the flower pot, put a sign, let me drop it. Put a sign in front of, on the front of this great big orange clay flower pot. They put a sign on the front of it that said, "Good Earth Ground." And they had a piece of 6-gauge wire coming out of the soil of that pot, and it was clamped on over to the antenna of the test. Now, each time that supervisor came in, said, "Where's the ground?" they pointed to that, and he was happy. Over to you, son. KC2WGB, K2LAW the TechNet. I think it's time we start the mailbag. You got it, John.
Dick, I would have dismissed him summarily immediately. That's funny. That's some crazy stuff. Let me let it drop, and I'll go over to the first question. And this is quite apropos because the first question is about grounding. So let me get my sheet. Okay, I have a consistent contributor to the mailbag here, Roy, who has a question about grounding. And he wants to know, it seems to be when he listens to the HF guys, that if your shack is not on the ground level, you cannot acquire a decent ground. Also, he would like to know if the ground connections on the back of the radios, usually have a ground terminal back there, if they're supposed to be grounded, or is the wire sufficient? His other question is, he doesn't believe what they're saying because look at the Empire State Building. I don't know if Eric's around. No, I think Eric's on vacation. How do they acquire a proper ground at that elevation? So somebody's not telling the truth, Dick. Maybe you can tell them if you had a shack and it was in the attic or on the second floor. I believe Mel's was on the second floor, as he indicated. How do you establish a good ground and what is sufficient? Exactly the topic we're talking about. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of ambiguity here. The word ground has at least 3 meanings. Number 1 is the kind of grounding for human safety reasons. Your Con Ed or Leiber wiring, its pole pig transformer, coming from the 13.2 kilovolt distribution voltage going down the top of the utility poles, going down all the blocks. That's got to be properly grounded to make sure human safety is present. The second kind of grounding is for lightning protection. Glenn's suggestion is that every piece of wire entering the house, whether it be from the utility pole, whether it be from your antenna, whether it be from your air conditioner, where that wire enters the house, there should be a local grounding rod right there. And those grounding rods serve a dual purpose. They're a backup to the Con Ed and Leiber wiring, and they're there for lightning protection. The third kind of grounding is for radio purposes, for what to make the radio signal work correctly. Now here we've got an entirely different kind of ground. If your antenna, let me drop it. If in the best of all worlds, your antenna is a thoroughly balanced thing, like a full half-wave dipole, no matter what the guys on 20 meters say, a properly fed half-wave dipole absolutely, positively requires no radio ground. You could be operating a transistorized transmitter held in your hand outside of your spacesuit, and you're floating in free space 1,000 feet behind the space shuttle or the International Space Station. You're truly in free space. Nothing around you except the Earth below you, 230 miles below you, if you know what I mean. Will that dipole work correctly when there's no local ground? Answer is absolutely, positively yes. Because with the radio signal, if it's properly being fed into that dipole, positive current is flowing into the right-hand side, negative current is flowing into the left-hand side of the dipole on this half cycle, and then on the other half cycle, they're both reversed. It's a thoroughly balanced system. The current is flowing between the halves of the dipole, and the radio signal gets radiated. That's the best of all worlds. And so, for radio purposes on a balanced antenna, the most ideal kind of antenna, absolutely no local ground is required. Let me drop. Life gets a little bit more complicated when you start running things like a vertical half-wave dipole, and if you're feeding it from the outside end, where the impedance is around 1,500 ohms, very little local grounding is required, but some kind of an impedance step-up device, an L network is required to step up the impedance. Life gets a little more complicated when you're now running a quarter-wave ground plane. In the case of a quarter-wave ground plane, how many ground plane radials you've got to act as the counterpoise is now going to affect how efficient your ground plane antenna is, because what you've done with those ground plane radials is you're trying to create the equivalent of an infinite sheet of conductor underneath that antenna, so that the quarter wave antenna above the ground and the mirror image of it below the ground gives you proper operation. There you might require a good number of ground plane radios to get high efficiency. And if you don't have a good number of ground plane radios, let me drop. You may still measure beautiful standing wave ratio, and you'll think everything's hunky-dory, but in reality, you can be launching a significant amount of RF energy into that volumetric resistive material called Earth. And so, for a whole bunch of reasons, I'm not in favor of quarter-wave ground plane antennas. A lot of people are using them. A lot of people love them. But because of, if you really are studying the nitty-gritty of high efficiency, you're going to desire 32 ground plane radials. Well, if you decide to make the antenna a half wavelength vertical instead of a quarter wavelength vertical, essentially all of that problem goes away. I'd much rather build a quarter wave, a half wave vertical dipole, as long as I've got a high enough support to hold it up in the air, as opposed to laying down 32 ground plane radials because I want 95% efficiency, if you know what I mean. So, three kinds of grounding, and I think he's now addressing the RF ground. Almost all the guys on 20 meters, so to speak, believe that if you don't have a good RF ground, that your antenna is not going to work well, no matter what kind of an antenna you're using. I say that's absolutely not true. If it's a thoroughly balanced antenna, like the driven element of a Yagi, for instance, and if you're properly feeding it, you don't need any ground, you don't need any earthing, any grounding, any RF grounding anywhere nearby. And that that Yagi can be operated from the 17th floor of your apartment building, and it's going to work like a charm. So that's some of the story. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
Okay, Dick, very good. So you think that if he was operating, say, in his third floor attic, he should run just one ground and use that ground, maybe a number six wire down to a ground rod, and use that for all his grounding purposes, and that should be sufficient. Say that's true?
For human protection and for lightning protection, yes. But he shouldn't depend on that piece of six-gauge wire from the attic down to Earth. He shouldn't depend on that as a RF ground. If he's running some kind of an antenna that needs an RF ground, and if he's using that, there are situations where that's less than ideal. He could make that piece of wire pretty hot, and it could give him some television interference and telephone interference and so on. The most desirable kind of an antenna to operate from that attic would be a balanced antenna like a half-wave dipole. And so quarter-wave-like things, well, there's another situation going on here. A quarter-wave ground plane antenna with ground plane radials can be extremely efficient if it's a high enough wavelength above ground. That station master antenna, that might be a 15-foot-long collinear antenna on 2 meters, and it has three little ground plane radials coming off the bottom of it at a 45-degree angle. That's a beautiful antenna with very high efficiency because those ground plane radials on that little antenna are, let me pick a number, 50 feet in the air, a good number of wavelengths above Earth. And the only reason for those three ground plane radials there is to make sure you're not launching a significant amount of current into the outside shield of the transmission line. So elevated ground plane antennas don't require a large number of ground plane radials. When your quarter wave ground plane antenna, your vertical quarter wave thing, is mounted on Mother Earth, you really are trying to create enough ground plane radials so that the RF energy cannot sneak in between those ground plane radials and see Earth and heat up that Earth. If the whole antenna is elevated high enough, you don't have to worry about that anymore. But that RF energy that can sneak between the radials, it's a very insidious thing. To measure its performance is very difficult because your visual meter won't show it to you, your current meter won't show it to you, unless you take some pretty careful measurements of field strength half a mile away. You won't know that you're losing half your efficiency by heating up the dirt in your backyard, making the worms happy in the wintertime, but it's not what you want to do RF-wise. Let me drop again. And just to get back to the way we hams began in the beginning, way back in, let me pick a number, 1925, the average ham radio operator was relegated to the attic of the wooden building. He's on the third floor. Quite often what he did is he's got his transmitter sitting on a wooden table in the middle of the attic, and he's got an 80-meter dipole where 67 feet of wire runs from 67 feet of wire runs out the eastern window, 67 feet of wire runs out the western window, and the transmitter is up in the air in the middle of the attic, and no transmission line at all is required. And that thing works like a charm. All of a sudden, at some later time, the ham got relegated to the basement, and now he needs a transmission line to going from the basement up to the attic antenna. And that's where twin lead, open wire line, and coaxial cable came along. And now there's some other laws you got to obey to make that work well. But don't worry about RF ground when you're at a high altitude in a building, as long as you're using the right kind of a balanced antenna. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Just one quick question on that same subject. If we were to put a poor man's balance at the beginning of the ground lead, wouldn't that eliminate the RF going down the ground lead?
Absolutely. And that's something we've never discussed. Should you put a poor man's balun, number of turns of wire, insulated even the turns from each other, on the ground lead from the third floor attic down to Earth to make sure no RF current is flowing into it? Darn good thing to do, because any current you launch into that wire could give you some grief as far as it being hot, and therefore as it passes by the television set, passes by the telephone, passes by the wiring of the house, it makes the wiring of the house hot, and that in turn creates electromagnetic interference. That could be a good belt and suspenders thing to do. I like that. We've never discussed that one up till now. We've never put a poor man's balun on a ground rod up till now, John. Maybe it's about time we do. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KD2,
Echo
okay, Dick. Very good. Yeah, I thought of that as you were speaking about it, and I just thought that might be something useful to do on the ground to prevent that. All right, we'll let it drop. We'll see if anybody else is out there with the further question, and I'll go on to the next one. KC2WGB for a little stall for anybody else out there.
I think I heard Joe, Echo Whiskey Oscar. Is that true, Joe?
UIS query. Yeah, I have a quick question. KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey, about grounding the radio.
Okay, we got Queen Yankee Whiskey and India Sierra in that order. Queen Yankee Whiskey, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My question is, I really need to ground all my equipment here. And my question is, don't they sell a artificial type of box mechanism that I could just ground all my space radios to a artificial ground that they sell?
They sell a kind of a box that people have used. I think they call it an artificial ground. I forgot what they call it. They sell a box that will force your long piece of wire going down to Earth to be a resonant length, and they want it to be a even number of quarter wavelengths electronically. So if you set up a grounding wire going three floors down from you, so to speak, and if you force it electronically to be an even number of quarter wavelengths, now the real ground that you see at the bottom of that wire will be electronically transposed to the top of that wire. So the wire will act like an RF ground at the top. And there's an advantage in doing that, and there's a disadvantage of doing that. The advantage of doing that is if you're foolish enough to use some kind of an antenna that will only perform RF-wise if it has a local RF ground, then that grounding resonating system will help you. But there's another catch that the manufacturer doesn't tell you about. In the process of him forcing that to be a quarter wavelength, an even number of quarter wavelengths, he is resonating it, and if you're dumping any significant current into that system, that piece of wire will be hot. And if it goes by the wiring of some other appliance in the house, you could have some television interference. So I don't recommend that approach, as you can tell. Over to you, Joe. KC2QIW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Roger that. I just ordered the ARRL antenna book, and it comes with a some kind of DVD. Hopefully it'll be in that book too to explain. And so I guess I gotta look for a cold copper, some kind of copper pipe. Over here I only have old fashioned radiators. I don't know if that's copper. Back to you.
Okay, there's a lot of information you're not giving me, Joe. And you seem to be discussing grounding. Is your concern of the three kinds of ground? Is it human protection grounding? Is it lightning protection grounding? Or is it radio grounding because you think you're going to use some kind of an antenna that will only behave well if it has radio ground? Which one of the three kinds of grounds are you now discussing, Joe? KC2QIW, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger that. Oh yeah, I'm sorry. I'm talking about. I'm not worrying about antennas and stuff because I always unhook everything when I'm not using my equipment. I'm talking about in the back of my FT950. It has in the back of it. It has that big wing nut, and it says ground on there. And on the antenna tuner too. Well, I didn't get it yet, but they have it on the back of the antenna tuner too. So my question is towards the equipment to ground the equipment.
In my opinion, Joe, that great big wing nut on the back of your transmitter on your antenna tuner, its primary purpose is to connect a wire from it. When you're running portable, if I'm out in the field on a field day operation and I've got a local grounding rod right outside of my tent, I'd like to run a wire for a whole bunch of safety reasons over to that wing nut. But when it comes to your home installation, if you're following Glenn's suggestion, you've got a grounding rod outside the house where the coax cables enter the house, and you're grounding those coax cables right where they enter the house. And therefore, you're not using that great big wing nut. I'm pretty sure that's what Glenn said. Let me turn it over to you, Joe, but drag your feet in case Glenn wants to correct me on that. KC2QIW with a delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Roger that. So what you're saying is, like you said, if you're doing a field day type of thing, then I use that to ground the radios and stuff. I'm at the home base, so I'm just referring at the home base.
Yeah, in my opinion, for home installations, very few people use that great big wing nut on the back of the rig. Because if your grounding wiring is going that far inside the house and using that wing nut, you're not getting all the benefit. To really be lightning grounding correctly, there should be a grounding rod outside the house, more than 12 inches away from the foundation, where that wiring, that grounding system takes place to your coax cables before they enter the house. Now, that's a slightly severe requirement, very appropriate for the lightning capital of Florida, where Glenn used to live. Do we really have to go that far on Long Island? It's a matter of how belt and suspenders you want to be.
KC2 QAQ.
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
Just a quick comment on this one, Dick. I look at it this way, you know, as far as, you know, hobbies and doing other things. And I just think that it's our responsibility as the hobbyist in the household who's going to put up an antenna and other things in the house to do everything within our means to make it as safe for anybody else that's in the house and that you don't burn down the house or cause a lightning strike on the house. Because if you have to replace a piece of cable or something else and explain, well, you know, the cable got weathered or something happened, that's one thing. Or, you know, but if you have to explain to the people in your household that the whole house just got damaged, burnt down, lightning striked because of your hobby, it's not a good place to be, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Sounds right.
You're telling me, Glenn, that my wife won't be happy if that occurs, and she won't be on my side. I understand. Okay. Any further questions on this one, Joe? KC2QIW, KQRIW?
No, I'm good. I feel safe now. And, I can't wait until I get that book now. And, back to the net.
Yeah, it's a good book. A lot of good information in there, particularly with the CD-ROM that they also give you in the back of it. Lots and lots of information. And by now, I think it's in its 22nd or 23rd printing. And so, obviously, 22nd or 23rd edition. I don't mean printing, edition. Lots of updates over the years. Maybe it's even the 24th. And so, you're going to enjoy it. I didn't say it's super simple, but by the time you study that book, you're going to be a lot smarter. Bill, AC2IS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Thanks, Dick. My question was about the idea of putting a ballon on a ground wire. Wouldn't that impede lightning trying to find ground, and wouldn't that be a problem?
You got a good point. Yep, there's a compromise there. Can we put enough of a ballon so that it stops RF current, but it's not enough significant inductance that it interferes with the lightning current flow? And so, if I'm on the third floor of a wooden house, I've got antennas going outside that house, and therefore for me to find local ground to my equipment is not easy. I don't know the answer to that one. You brought up a good point. I don't know the answer to that one. Anybody got a better suggestion? K2RIW?
I've got a ton of them, Dick.
Yeah, I think you're going to say don't do it. Go ahead, Glenn.
I can tell you right now my station is on the second story, and how I generally do it is I put a plate on the outside of the house at the second story where the entrance point is, where all the wires come into the house at that point, and basically just decouple everything where the twin lead comes in, or you know, your balanced wire cables. I have a piece of plexiglass with drilled out 3/8 bolts that run through, and right at that spot where just before the entrance comes in, I have a ballon over there. So I've got a ballon up one end of my feed line, and I've got a ballon up on the antenna side. So I've got ballons on both ends, and it's grounded on both ends. So I run the ground wire from the ballon directly down into a 6-gauge wire into the ground, and from where the antenna feed point is, I've got a ground. And you can look at, like, DX Engineering. They have beautiful ballons that are pre-made with the wing nut right on the outside, so you can do the wire feed on one side, the coaxial feed on the other side, and basically have your balanced line running from both ends with transformers on both ends and grounded on both ends, and absolutely no problem at all. KC2QIQ.
That sounds like the right way to do it. Okay. Looks like we're not going to put a poor man's ballon on grounding rods, not grounding, wiring from the second floor or whatever of the house. Looks like we dumped that idea. Who had that one? Go ahead with your next mailbag item, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, I don't think making a few turns to make a poor man's ballon is going to make much difference. But, of course, what Glenn said is probably the proper way to do it. But he may be able to get away with it. I don't know. I want to thank Roy for bringing that up. It was a perfect night for it. So we learned a lot about grounding, that's for sure. Let me let her drop, and I'll go on to my next one. I'll squeeze one more in before the science or the space program. All right. All right, KC2WGB, back online here. Okay, got a young listener who has a pretty good idea. He wants to know if it would be possible, with all of the superconductors that they're building, why couldn't they make a superconductor and send it into space where we shouldn't need the cooling fluids for superconductivity? Do you think that would work, Dick? Not you.
A superconductor in space, okay, many of the high-temperature superconducting materials, I think, become superconducting at temperatures as high as 100 degrees Kelvin. And so, as long as the sun is not directly shining on your piece of electronics, as long as your electronics is truly exposed to the black side, the backside of your spacecraft, and it's really looking into cold space. Cold space is around 2.7 degrees Kelvin. So, yes, you sort of automatically get superconducting temperature without worrying about liquid nitrogen and things like that, and cryogenics and refrigeration. You get that sort of automatically in free space. In your spacecraft gets that as long as the sun is not shining on your particular superconducting piece of equipment. I think that's what you're saying, but I'm not sure. Back to you for more information here, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, you have it right. He watched a program where they were showing the floating magnets above these superconducting elements, and then he thought about all that cryogenics. Why wouldn't it work in space? And I agree with you, as long as the sun, or if we were out far enough where the sun wasn't going to generate that much heat, that might work. So that's a good thought by this guy.
But now what are you going to do with it? On Earth, we need superconducting in order to make super strong magnets for our MRI machine and for particle accelerators like the Large Hadron Collider. So these great big machines, the MRI machine, with rare exception until somebody finds a way of doing super compacting, you're not going to put an MRI machine in space. At least all the MRI machines I've seen, they're massive pieces of hardware. You're not going to put one of those in space until, I mean, if somebody proposed to put that on a really big spacecraft called the International Space Station, maybe. But even then, how would you lift that thing into space and properly maintain it? On top of that, there's a hell of a lot of safety procedures that have to be followed when you're using an MRI machine. If within, let me pick a number, 100 yards of that MRI machine, you allow somebody to bring a large metallic object, like, for instance, a CO2 container, a liquid nitrogen, a dry nitrogen container. You allow somebody to bring that even in the same corridor or the same room with an MRI machine. You're putting human beings at a huge amount of risk. You probably have heard the drop. You heard the situation where somebody did put one of those containers in the room of an MRI machine, and it got sucked into the magnet while a human being was there. It crashed into the person's head and killed them. So, for a whole bunch of reasons, I don't think you're ever going to put an MRI machine on a space station. So, the point I'm getting here is that those are the main reasons we need superconducting on the Earth and certain kinds of pure research. You would like to think that your antenna is going to become more efficient and your filter is going to become more efficient if you build it out of superconducting materials. Well, if you use good choice of materials in the first place, your antenna is going to give you 98% efficiency. Your transmission line, if you're using the right kind and a short enough length of it in space, it's going to give you 98% efficiency. So with rare exception, I don't think there's a real need for superconducting in space. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech pad.
Well, Dick, I believe what he was thinking of was the purpose would be to generate electricity, possibly, or to maybe suspend gyros so that they wouldn't have some of these problems they're having with gyros. Might be something like that. I'm not sure. But I thought it was a good question. I've never thought of it myself.
There are magnetic bearings that have been used on gyros in space with ordinary neodymium magnets. I don't think there's a need for superconducting to do a suspension, a magnetic suspension of a gyro bearing. Now, why are inertial wheels in space on the Hubble Space Telescope, why they keep failing is not quite clear to me. I think I'm going to make a guess on this one, and that is they're not using it as a gyroscope per se. They're using it as an inertial wheel. When they want to steer Hubble, let's assume that Hubble is aimed north and now you want to steer it to the east, and Hubble weighs quite a few tons. For you to move Hubble from north toward east, you're going to be spinning up one of these inertial wheels for a certain length of time while it is in transition, and then you're going to slow it down after you get it on station. And so that speed up and slow down procedure of the inertial wheel, somewhere in there a failure takes place. And I don't think it's a bearing failure. You would think it's a bearing failure. I think it's not. I think it's electronic failure on the method by which you spin it up and slow it down. That's what I think the failure is. And would that failure suddenly go away because you've used superconductivity there? I ain't sure. I know that there are a number of spacecraft where the gyros didn't fail. I'm guessing there's gyros on Voyager. Voyager is 37 years old, and from all I can tell, it hasn't had any gyro failures.
Repeater, time out.
If I did a study of Hubble, I think I'm going to find out that the mean time between failures of the gyros on Hubble is probably 3 years. You know, some crazy number like that. How come the gyros on Hubble have a mean time between failure of 3 years, and the ones on Voyager are there 37 years and still cranking? There's a bunch of questions I've got on that one. I'll have to ask Paul. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, we'll throw it out to Paul. Maybe he has an answer for that. But you know, my experience with gyros from my cameras, before they came out with this steady cam equipment that they have now, we had a three-axis gyro that used to bolt onto the Leica equipment or the Hasselblad. And you would speed those boys up, and they would get up to like 20,000 RPMs. I mean, you would hear these things whiz up, and they worked very well. And they do fail, usually bearing failures on the ones that I had. That was the problem, which they may not be having from what you're saying. But, yeah, gyros are interesting, a lot of fun. But, okay, let's go over to Paul, and that's it for the mailbag, KC2WGB. And I'd like to thank everybody for the questions, and we'll continue next week. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, John, you usually time my monologue, and you didn't tell me what the timing of the monologue was today. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
Okay, now we're going to chastise. You were 4 minutes late, Dick, and you took 2 minutes to get back on. So that was 6 minutes.
Oh, well. I'll be better next week. Paul, WS2N, what have you discovered? A really tough question we asked you last week was, is there more than one traveling wave tube on Voyager? And I think it's almost impossible without talking to Mr. Stone. Mr. Stone, I think his name is the chief investigator. WS2N with our space report. K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Good, it's WS2N, very good. And I was thinking about Gravity Probe B before. I got a hum here. For some reason. All right. We lowered a speaker anyway. Get an RF into my external speaker. Gravity Probe B has these balls, these perfectly round balls. They spent a fortune making them perfect, and they're floating and spinning and keeping that spacecraft perfectly aligned to make precise measurements of the Earth spinning below the gravity well turning below it as it goes over a polar type of orbit. And over time, it actually moves to try to prove that this theory was correct, and then that's working, but, you know, without cryogenics. It doesn't need a superconductivity, and I don't think it has the cryogenics. It's just a perfectly spinning ball. But let me drop it. Okay, got rid of the hum. I thought John was going to talk about your monologue. It went so fast he couldn't time it. You asked about the, let me go out of step here. I did find information about traveling wave tubes, but not with Voyager, but with New Horizons. They have two of them on board, two 12-watt traveling wave tubes on the New Horizons spacecraft going to Pluto 2015 in July. And now they found a way to actually twin them together. There's going to be so much information that comes back. They ran a test a couple of years back when it went past Pluto. They used Pluto as a gravity assist. They didn't use the other planets, just Pluto. And they ran a nice test on it. And the amount of data, digital data that came back was almost equal to all the data that Galileo sent back. And it's going around Jupiter, you know, the digital pictures were just perfect. But they're going to lose a lot of, I think they said it was, 36K per second or something. I forgot the number, but it's like 1/36 of that will be what you get from Pluto when it goes past Pluto. So, you know, and that's just using the one traveling wave tube. So they want to figure out a way to double it, and they run some tests. And they have that nailed. They know what to do. They'll program it. They can do that. So it's almost all the way to Pluto. They'll reprogram it to operate two traveling wave tubes.
Repeater, time out.
Time out, Dick.
You timed out for a quarter of a second, and then you figured it out. Perfect. Paul, go ahead.
Okay, very good. Well, we know Voyager has one traveling wave tube, and it said it was like 23 or 24 watts was the report on that. But these are two 12-watt ones. So that's pretty good. It's a different design than Voyager. Naturally, it's upgraded and all, you know, the best of everything, including the way it's going to transmit back to Earth. It's going to
point its instrument to Pluto, and it's going to rotate the whole body of the spacecraft, and you know, so you don't get any blurring effect with all the instruments on board, including the photography they're going to do. And as it turns, it's going to store all that data, and then afterwards, it's going to turn back to Earth and then send that information back. Voyagers weren't designed like that. They had these articulating stands that everything was on, and no matter where the, as long as the spacecraft was pointing toward Earth, we got information 100% of the time, and these platforms would turn, and it would rotate past all the planets to do that on Voyager 1 and 2. Much more expensive design, and it worked good up until Voyager 2 going past Saturn. It wound up with a problem and it couldn't do that anymore. So it's, what are we going to do? And it turns out they're doing what they're doing now on New Horizons. They have the they knew it wasn't working. The moving platforms weren't working, so they took Voyager 2.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Moons involved, and it rotated the spacecraft just like that, and then at the end sent the information back to Earth. So, brief history on the comparison of the two spacecraft. We have a lot more stuff to go over here. Should I continue, or do you have any questions about this?
I do remember that that gimbal, the motor moving the platform on one of the Voyagers, and I guess it was Voyager 2, did go into some kind of a jam-up mode. So rather than trying to move it, I think it's saying they moved the whole spacecraft. Because that worked so well, that's what they're doing on New Horizons. However, when you move the whole spacecraft, you're either making a heavy use of your inertial wheels, which could eventually create a failure of them, or you're using your orientation gas, your hydrazine, that allows you to point the spacecrafts. But I guess there was enough on board that that was a worthwhile thing to do. A bunch of guesses on my part, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, they got the hydrazine fuel, and with the with both spacecraft, they have the inertial wheels, the moment they call them moment inertial wheels, spinning up and slowing down of those wheels, you can rotate the spacecraft. So all your fine-tuning is done with those, and then if you want to make a little drastic turn, you'll fly one of the maneuvering jets. I think most of it's done with the spinning wheels. Well, and, you know, you talked about that before. Hubble is a very heavy thing. I forgot what it weighs, but many, many tons compared to Voyager, which, you know, maybe a ton of, probably 2,000 pounds or so. And New Horizons even less, probably in the 1,000 pound area. New Horizon looks like a grand piano. If you take the 14 foot diameter dish, I think it's a little smaller on New Horizon, put that on top of the piano. Close the piano top, the grand piano, and put the dish on top. And that's kind of what it would look like. The traveling wave tubes are below that. RTG, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators, they have that. They always try to keep that far away from the spacecraft itself. So it looks like if you took a bar stool and jammed it in where the piano keys are, have it sticking out. Interesting. Design, and so everything's working well. You know, I mean, they ran a complete check when it went through the Jupiter space, and it goes to sleep, and every 6 months or so they wake it up and make sure everything's working. So, So that's pretty much the story on the on New Horizon. And we're going to be talking about that in about a year and a half, July of 2015. So that's coming up. Nine and a half years to get there. Just want to mention a couple of launches. I missed one. I should have reported one last week that went up the following Monday of last week's net from Wallops Island. Orbital Science launched a smaller rocket called Minotaur 1. But they launched it into orbit, and they had on it 29 satellites that they released. Very small ones, you know. Some of them you can hold in your hand. And it went off successfully, but it was a very clear night, and I got reports from other people that I know that they did see it. You could see it from New York, probably about 15 degrees above the horizon, looking southwest, which is pretty cool. And then, you know, they have another, you know, one good thing about Orbital Science, that's their main, I mean, they'll launch from other places, but that's their main location for launches in Virginia. They do have one coming up in December 15th. Another Antares Cygnus spacecraft that they're going to launch to the International Space Station with more cargo. The second time for them to do this. And that will be one of these flights that you'll be able to see rising out of the, well, it looks like out of the ocean if you're down by Jones Beach. And that should be interesting. It's 10:52 launch at night, Eastern Standard Time. So,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Falcon 9 1.1. Actually, tomorrow from Cape Canaveral. Is Complex 40. It's like dedicated to them. And on top of that, rocket. They have the orbital built SES-8 spacecraft. I mentioned this before a number of times on the net, but it's a commercial satellite being put to geosynchronous orbit, which, you know, what's different about this launch is it's the first time for SpaceX to put a spacecraft into geosynchronous orbit. And if all goes well, they're going to do the same thing next month with a different company, a different satellite from the same location, from Florida. And what's nice about this mission is you have two competing companies, SpaceX and Orbital Sciences, teaming up. The spacecraft built by Orbital Science for European satellite company. It's going to be located over Asia. But being launched by the SpaceX group. SpaceX, a few months ago, was planning on every launch from now on in with their upgraded Falcon, planning on relighting the boosters to eventually show that they could bring them back to land for reusability. They planned on that this flight and the next flight to do that, but that's been canceled. They want to dedicate everything to these two companies that we drive it. Private companies that want the satellites up there, and considering that they did have a problem with their booster a month or so ago from Vandenberg Air Force Base when they launched Cassiopeia up for Canada, they relit the first and second stage boosters. They want to show that they can bring them back. It's an interesting picture. The first booster, you know, I mean, it hit the water pretty hard, but the engine was firing when it did, and it was coming down, you know, tail first. So they get in there with the second booster. I mean, with the first primary booster, second stage. They wanted to reignite that to show that they could do the same thing eventually. Reignited for, well, I don't know, maybe a second or two, and then it shut itself down. They had a problem with that. So because of that problem, that second stage has to reignite. night to put a spacecraft in geosynchronous orbit. Cassiopeia wasn't one of those flights. In fact, it was a polar flight. But this one is geosynchronous orbit. This time they think they find out their problems. Something to do with refiring up in a vacuum. Some controls or something wasn't working. So this time they think they know what they're doing. Hope they do, because that rocket has to reignite to get them to geosynchronous orbit 23,000 miles above the Earth. So if that all goes well, then same thing next month with the other company, I think it's Diacom, or I don't know, another Asian outfit. And they're going to put another satellite up in geosynchronous orbit. The flight after that is scheduled for International Space Station next year, or early next year. And on that one, they want to reignite the second stage. And the first, but well, what will really be cool, this is going to be the first time, if they make it in time with the engineering, they said they're going to put landing legs on the first stage. So you're going to see these landing legs when the thing takes off attached to the first stage. Because that's the goal eventually, that, you know, when it comes back, they're going to have these big landing legs open up and it's going to land on the ground, like I said, tail first. So that's an interesting setup, what SpaceX is up to and what they plan on doing. Just one other mission I wanted to mention that went up a couple of days ago. It's not only NASA, it's Russia and everybody else. Well, European Space Station has a group called Eurorocket, and they operate actually out of Russia, just north of Moscow, northeast of Moscow, and they have a launch facility there that they use. And they launched a rocket called Swarm, S-W-A-R-M. And what this is three satellites in one. And the idea is to measure the magnetic field around the Earth. I mean, for many, many years they plan on doing this. And to do it, the two will be in the lower orbit, and they have springs or something pushing against each other when they separate, where over time they're going to get further and further apart. The inclination is going to change to the point where in a year or so they're going to be, I don't know, some huge degree apart from one another. And the other one above will stay where it is, looking down on the other two. And they're going to be taking measurements of the magnetic field in 3D. I look back and I can only find one reference of satellites out, you know, Earth orbiting type of satellites that NASA put up about 5-6 years ago called Thermos. That was a series of five satellites that had different type of orbit. But this Swarm deal that they put up is supposed to have very sensitive instruments. I'm not too sure how they all work, but they're going to detect the magnetic field and see what that's all about. It's going to help us understand how the sun interacts with it and how many amps get pushed back into the northern region. They say it's almost a million amps a second or something. Some huge amount that's constantly being put back. But a lot of scientists are into this, and that's why they're doing it. But it will help understand the ionosphere, radio propagation, and also a lot of science is going to come out of this Swarm mission. These things you don't hear much about. In fact, last week, you know, after the MAVEN mission went up, and that went up successfully in Mars, I set a couple of different recorders for different stations, and nobody had it on CNN, Fox News, nobody anywhere. So thank goodness for the computer. I got to see that thing take off. Dick, that's pretty much it. I know it's quite a bit, but back to that. WS2N. One other thing. Anybody wants to contact me, spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to that. WS2N.
Thank you, Paul. When it comes to New Horizons having a pair of 12-watt traveling wave tubes, that gives you a couple of interesting capabilities. You've probably heard of something called a balanced amplifier technique. That's where when you've got a pair of amplifiers that are essentially identical to each other, and you put a quadrature hybrid in front acting as a power divider, and another quadrature hybrid behind acting as a power summer, the advantage is now you get, yes, twice the power of any one amplifier, you can get very high efficiency, and you have something called graceful degradation. If either one of those amplifiers fail, you're still on the air. You go down 6 dB in power, but you're still on the air. That's one way of using two amplifiers in a safe manner, and you can tolerate at least one failure. Let me drop. And another technique is that if you've got two separate amplifiers, and if you have two separate antennas, you could allow all the power combining to take place in space. The advantage of that system is that if one amplifier fails, you now only go down, you go down 3 dB in power output, but you lose the antenna pattern of the phased array of two antennas, which means you lose 3 dB of antenna gain. You still go down 6 dB. Oh, well. But at least it's graceful degradation. You're still on the air. So I wonder if they mentioned any words along those lines with those two amplifiers. And you seem to be discovering that Voyager has only one traveling wave tube on each Voyager. Therefore, if that tube should fail, I think we will never talk to Voyager again. WS2N, KQLIW in the tech net.
I think Voyager probably only has one, but I can't confirm that, you know. But this other thing, New Horizons. I was wondering last week if you could use modern upgraded stuff. Well, this thing was only launched, 7.5 years ago. That's pretty modern. And sure enough, you wind up with the two traveling wave tubes, not solid state equipment. They had a high gain dish, classic grain layout, but they've got a 7-foot diameter. Really not as big as I think Voyager was 14. This is 7-foot diameter. It provides well over 4 dB gain and a half power beam width of about 1 degree. What else did I have here? Prime focus, medium gain antenna with a 0.3 meter, 1 foot aperture. You know, they got some kind of a half power beam width. It's like 10 watts. I'm not sure what they mean by that. Well, it's mounted to the back of the high gain antenna, secondary reflector. So they've got a low gain antenna, which they really only use around in Earth orbit in case something went wrong, a thing lost, went out of whack and wasn't facing the right direction. It was set up with that, but the low gain that they're really not going to use. So they got two medium gains and one high gain beam. But that's the
repeater. Time out. Repeater. Time out. Cancel.
The receivers are. Let me drop it. The receivers are new, low power design. The system can be controlled to power both traveling wave tubes at the same time and transmit a dual polarized downlink signal to the deep space network. You know what that is? That's the group that's antennas all over the Earth, 120 degrees apart from one another. Madrid, Goldstone, Australia. So they'll have constant contact.